Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Welcome to this week's FX Podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. This week, it's back to regular audio podcasts. Over the last few weeks, we did some stories that required QuickTimes to help explain them. So those are available on the site and may not have made it to your machine if you were listening via the iTunes subscription. But these were on the Guinness Reverse Evolution spot and part one of our series on matte paintings, so they're quite interesting. You might want to check those out. Let's get right to this week's podcast. Since it's the end of the year, we thought we'd do something a little bit different and talk to a writer about how the writer of a major episodic TV show approaches visual effects. So Mike Seymour talked to Doug Naylor, co-producer and founder of the UK TV show Red Dwarf. For those who don't know, Red Dwarf is a major cult classic, also responsible for selling millions of DVDs and books. The show started with a very, very low budget for visual effects. Mike talked to Doug about that and a lot more, so let's join Mike and Doug Naylor.
Thanks for joining us, Doug.
No, it's great to be here.
So, look, just give us a quick plotted history of Red Dwarf, the show, basically when it started, and also whether you'd characterize it as comedy or effects.
How brief do you want the plotted history to be? an hour later. 3 minutes?
Sure.
3 minutes. Okay, plotted history from the beginning. Rob and I were script editors on a show called Spitting Image, which was a satirical puppet show for ITV. And we went in season two when it was in trouble, and we're given a carte blanche to change the format to try and make it work, and we had to double viewing figures in the time we were there, and that worked out really well. But then in the holiday season after that, we sat down and said we wanted to do our own thing, because there was the frustration of just having to work with so many people and other writers being involved in everything else, which was great, but we just wanted to do our own thing. So we went to Wales in a cottage for a week, and previous to that we'd written a radio show called Son of Cliché, which had a variety of recurring sketches, one of which was called Dave Holling's Space Cadet, which was about sort of satiric homage to Alien, about the lone survivor of a spaceship going slightly crazy with his computer, and they were the only two characters in this sketch. And we did four or five of them, and the audience liked them. They didn't absolutely love them, but we thought it was a really interesting format to develop into a sitcom. So we went to this cottage in Wales, and we knew we had the hero was going to be called Dave, and we knew there was this slightly nutty computer, and then it was, how do we people this ship with a few more characters? We didn't want aliens, because all science fiction series have aliens, and we felt that if we avoided aliens, that would give us something unique. And we also didn't want robots for the same reason. So we looked around, and the first character type we came up with was a hologram. So we had Lister, we had a human and a hologram. And previous to this, we'd been invited to lunch by the head of Radio 4, who was called Bobby J, to go to lunch with Goldman Simpson, who wrote the old Steptoe and Son and Hancock shows, which was a huge privilege, and we were able to pick the brains for the best part of 3 hours. One of the things that they told us was how they created Steptoe and Son, and they said that Steptoe and Son, they didn't know who Steptoe and Son were, they were just going to write about two male characters walking down the street. And so they wrote these two characters walking down the street for about two pages. And then around about page two, they decided to make them two brothers. And I can't remember what the jobs were. The jobs changed. So they were just right. They didn't rewrite. They just wrote. And, you know, chat. The car mechanics, brothers. And then they wrote a few more pages, developed the characters. And then around about page five, and the characters were obviously conflicting all the time, because that's where the comedy is. And then around about page seven, they made them rag and bone men. Rag and Bone Men brothers, and then around about page 9, they made them father and son because they felt there was more conflict there. So we thought, oh, that's really interesting, that's fascinating, because they didn't discuss the characters, they just started to write. And so we thought that's exactly what we'll do with our two characters. We know one is a hologram and we know one is a human. We don't know quite why it's a hologram. Maybe it was some accident and that's why he became a hologram. So we then wrote basically the two characters walking down a corridor with conflict in that scene, and that was basically the opening scene of Red Dwarf. And then working backwards from that, in terms of the plot, we realised that there would have to be some accident to cause the hologram to come into being, and as a consequence of that, we had the idea of Lister's cat evolving into a new life form. So that was basically how the characters came together.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, sure.
The characters are obviously what tends to drive both the comedy and the drama, but I'm interested in, you know, you've set it in a spaceship.
Mm.
So comedy and space wasn't an immediately obvious pairing. And the second thing is, like, in that respect, how much did you have to at some point just try and work out the laws or the constraints that you would place on the characters? Because clearly once you set them in a futuristic or sci-fi environment, you can sort of write your own laws of physics almost.
Well, it was interesting. We didn't really think anyone would have a problem with it set in space. It seemed like such an obvious idea. In fact, Rob and I remember watching Dark Star. I remember this so vividly. We watched it and then we went off to the pub, and I remember I was driving and just standing at the car going, I can't for the life of me understand why no one has ever done a sitcom like that. And Rob went, yeah, it's really weird, isn't it? And then we both got in the car, drove off, and, you know, just didn't talk about it, just moved on to something else. And then when we came back, it was like, why hasn't there been more comedy in space? And people's reaction was, well, there has, Hitchhiker's Guide. And you go, no, but that's not what we're talking about. Hitchhiker's Guide is ideas-driven, whereas a character-driven science fiction would be, no, we don't think anyone's done that, especially for comedy. And people didn't really get it, and certainly the people at the BBC didn't get it. And we went there and we explained it to them, and they just said, no one will be able to relate with the situation. You know, people on a spaceship, if it was set in someone's sitting room and behind them there were French windows and a sofa where they could go, oh, this is just like my home, then they could relate to it, but they would never be able to relate to it if it was just a spaceship. And this was basically because the head of comedy at the time didn't watch any movies. He didn't know about Alien. He didn't know about Terminator. He was vaguely aware of Star Wars, but he didn't understand that there was a whole generation. Of course, they wouldn't have any problem at all relating to people on spaceships. I mean, for goodness sake, Star Trek, you know? And if you'd just got, I mean, basically, it was a funny Star Trek in its crudest terms, you know? A bunch of weird people on a spaceship having adventures. But, you know, they didn't get it. And 3 years went by, well, we couldn't sell it to anyone, and then just pure by chance, BBC London was sort of the in charge of what went on TV, but there was another BBC in Manchester who had this slot, and they were allowed to get, occasionally allowed to get things on TV, and they had this slot of 6 half-hours, and it was sent to them, and they read it, and they were looking for something that was weird. So if it failed, it wouldn't fail in an ordinary way. So they were protected. So they could go, well, hey, what do you expect? It failed. We were trying something different. It failed. You know, at least we weren't just doing the same old traditional stuff. And so they read it. I don't think particularly understood it. But because of the people involved and because they thought it was weird and there was a character there who had evolved from a cat, they felt that was weird enough to... for them to give the green light to it. which is what happened.
But,
and then we kind of stumbled along and eventually worked out how sort of to make it work.
And I was just going to mention my second point. Was at any point that you sort of stopped and worked out your rule book of what was possible in this environment or not? Or was it just, you know, anything went? I mean, there's a lot of flexibility.
Yeah, there were conversations where you could spend 3 hours talking about anti-gravity, you know, and, you know, what keeps the feet on the floor. When you're in space, do we have sound effects on the spaceship? Because actually you wouldn't be able to hear them. So there should really be silence. And then after about 3 hours of talking about having silent sound effects and how limiting that is, and then one of us would go, but look, they don't do that in Star Wars. Who cares? It's not real. No one will think it's not real because there's, you know, not that many people know you can't hear sound in space, and they'll just accept it. And anyway, you know, we're trying to be funny and get this across to an audience that we haven't got yet, so shut up and let's write some jokes.
In some respects, you actually used that to your advantage, didn't you? Because in one of the episodes, and I'm sorry, it escapes me which one, but the guys find a time machine and they're out in deepest space and they decide to go back to the 17th century. And whiz-bang, you know, the time machine's activated and they're all enthusiastic about being in Napoleonic, France. Look out the window and they're still in deepest, darkest space. And you're playing there with that whole concept that they travel in time but not in space. The thing that, you know, in every other science fiction, they go, a time machine, and oh, by the way, we've moved across the planet. So you really had fun with those concepts as well, didn't you?
Yes, to the most interesting place, yes. Because, because you have the audience has expectations because, you know, which is really undercutting what the BBC originally were saying, which is that they don't have any expectations because it's a genre they're not familiar with. But, you know, but they have. That's absolutely right.
And a couple of episodes you wrote, which were like both breaking everybody's expectation, but also I would imagine doing your head in, were famous episodes like the Backwards episode. Can you, like, explain how you write for something like that, which is just mind-numbingly complex?
Yes, that was mind-numbing, and the Future Echoes scene in Future Echoes was mind-numbing as well. Backwards was... in fact, it's interesting as well, the Future Echoes scene, I don't know if you remember that, but but when we rehearsed that, people just went, why is this funny? And it will be funny, but it will only be funny when you see it cut together. But it's not funny now.
I remember those scenes well as characters came in and out
out
of sync.
And there was a real element of, God, what are we doing? You know, and the director said, "This is funny. Will this? Is this funny?"
So for those that don't,
it will be. It will be. Thinking, is it?
So just for those that don't remember the scene, this is characters that are walking in and delivering a line that another character will walk into in a minute and react to. So the audience is in the know.
That's exactly right, yeah.
But filming was completely disjoint.
The time is slightly out of sync. He's seeing a future conversation, and then it only makes sense when it's repeated. See how funny it sounds? and you see, if you'd have had someone there going, guys, just write some jokes, or, you know, I don't think this is funny, just cut it. But there was, once we got on, BBC Manchester just left us alone. They let us just do it. And so that was fantastic. Backwards, there were all sorts of problems with Backwards. For a start, the edit machines wouldn't play anything backwards. And all the time code went completely ape. It was very difficult to rehearse backwards scenes because you can only really rehearse them forwards and then play them backwards, see what they look like, and then edit accordingly. And obviously your in point is your out point, and your out point is your in point, and all that. And of course, you know, we were talking earlier about shooting stuff on green screen and how actors don't find that fun. They don't also don't find fun walking forwards into a lake and going down in the water and then saying, but when it's played backwards, it will look like, you know, blah, 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 and it will look really funny. Because they're just kind of mystified. Because, you know, and also we didn't have, you know, the machinery then to go, look, hang on, we'll just play it back. There you go, that's what it'll look like. Oh, I get it.
Did you find to wait
to be edited and then played back.
Did you find including visual effects, as a writer, did you find including visual effects a liberating thing because you could get out of any kind of writing hole, or an annoyance because it kind of broke the flow once you got on set?
The thing we found was, because our budget was very small, and it was one of the things that we never had enough money to do, was to rehearse and to test a lot of the equipment. So I remember, for example, Polymorph, the animatronic genetic mutant from season 3, that just, you know, didn't work. A lot of the time, the scooters, taxis would drive past the studio and interfere with the scooters, and on one famous occasion they attacked Chris Barry's leg during the live show, just because, you know, so in, on a film or something with a bigger budget, you can test it, so, you know, things will always go wrong, but they always went wrong, you know, nearly all the time anyway, when we were making it. So in some aspects it was extremely frustrating, because we'd have to keep stopping and then it would be fixed and then we'd be tested and then we'd try it again and all of that. However, we never just wrote, oh well, you know, this special effect or will magically get it out of this problem, because we were always very, very cynical. One, whether they would look any good, and two, whether it would work. And so, for example, Gunman of the Apocalypse in season 6, we had an idea to write a Western episode, and we had the barest skeleton of a plot. But we didn't attempt to write anything until we'd phoned the production team and said, is there a Western town anywhere? This is a real long shot. We don't suppose there is, but is there, or something that can be made to look like a Western town? And they came back a week later and said, there's this place called The Radio in Kent, and apparently it looks like a Western town, and guys dress up as cowboys and women dress up as cowgirls, and you're not allowed to wear any kind of contemporary paraphernalia like watches or anything. And they go there and they spend the weekend there living like cowboys. And we went, oh, okay. And they said, do you want to check it out? And so we went, yeah, terrific. So at this point, we were then pretending that we'd written the scripts, and we had to go there and describe the plot, which hardly existed, and look at the place. We saw it, it looked terrific. And then as a consequence of that, we went off and we wrote the show, went off to shoot it, and simultaneously the script went to the head of whichever department was supposed to be in control of us then, which was headed by a woman called Janet Street Porter. And she read the script and called our agent in and said, I've read the script, absolutely ridiculous. It's impossible to shoot. And, you know, tell those boys that they're absolutely, they've lost their marbles and they need to write something more sensible. And our agent was able to say, well, actually, they finished shooting it yesterday. And so there was a whole element of not just writing any old bloody thing we felt like, but knowing that it was possible within the confines of our budget and on what we were able to do, which is why Viz Effects and that area has always fascinated me, because it allows you to open another door into, now this new universe is accessible to, it's accessible to your budget, not to your mind, but to your budget, because you constantly, if you want to write for TV and movies even to an extent, you have a budget, you know, and a budget can only buy you certain things.
And
having said that, certain budgets, you know, sometimes it's good to have, you know, parameters and limitations, because you can be more creative that way. But then equally, if you can go, did you know you can do this, that can give you great fit to your imagination.
Red Dwarf is has had 8 series and been very successful and sold millions of books as well as DVDs and stuff. You're about to release the DVD of Series 7, and yet I think I read somewhere once that you always felt a bit like an outsider of the BBC comedy circuit because, I guess, because it's still seen as being more sci-fi than it is straight comedy. Would that be... Is that true? Did I read that correctly?
I think it's a number of things. One is BBC London, which is like the proper BBC, rejected it 3 times. We then got it on through BBC Manchester, who at the time just made... It was like 2 quiz shows and mainly radio. So they didn't really produce that much network television at the time. And we made 3 seasons there. And we were all coming from London and having to travel up to Manchester, which is, on a good day, 3.5 hours on a coach, and then coming back 3.5 hours after the show. And then if there was a traffic jam because it's up and down the motorway, it was a really long, draining time. And we were doing this every week, because we would rehearse down in London because that's where everyone lived. We moved up to Manchester, moved back down to London. So season 4, we moved to Shepperton Studios, which is, the major studios outside of London. And so then we were sort of cut adrift even from BBC Manchester. We were sort of like, God knows what. Just this company that makes this show and has no contact with any kind of BBC. And generally when all the BBC stars get together, it's a light entertainment Christmas party. But because we were still officially deemed as BBC Manchester, no one from the show got invited because it was the London Light Entertainment. And we won the Emmy, I think, after season 6, and I phoned and I said, look, we've just won the Emmy. I really think it's time we got invited. And they went, really sorry, but we've got absolutely a maximum number of people. If you guys came, you would be a fire risk. And I phoned and pulled as many strings as I could, and eventually they relented. And, just won the Emmy. Just won the Emmy. You can't not invite them. This is ridiculous. So they eventually do get invited. So in that sense, we were always outsiders. And I think there's a story about Monty Python as well, that the more successful they got, the farther they were moved outside of the BBC and wound up in some porter cabin, in Shepherd's Bush Market or somewhere. And also because none of the cast, although Chris went on and did Britis, none of them wanted to do the chat shows, where it's like, here he is, here's a big celebrity and all that stuff. So they were mainly known through doing Red Dwarf. So there was certainly an outsidery feel, which is fine. Nothing wrong with that. It made us probably closer than ever.
Well, thanks for taking time to talk to us. I just would be remiss if I didn't ask you, Series 7, which is just going on sale for Christmas, any favourite bits, any fond memories in terms of the actual show itself?
There are lots of things. I think Ticket to Ride is one of the most dangerous episodes we've ever done. It upsets some people and thrills others. The version that's on the DVD has replaced all the CGI, and I particularly hated the CGI in season 7. There's a long story which is explained in the documentaries why that came about. But so the CGI has been replaced, and it's got the extended ending on. So that's a show I'm proud of, Ticket to Ride, which is the first show. And there are some, some fantastic sequences with Craig and Craig and Robert, with Clayton Griffin jealous about Kachansky coming on board. And it was a strange season 7, because Chris left and then came back. And Chloe came in, and we had to kind of work out what worked for her, And then, of course, as everyone knows, Chris decided to come back for good in season 8. And I had a feeling that's what would happen, which is why I didn't want to replace him in season 7. So it was a difficult, and also it was the first season Rob didn't do. So it was an interesting season.
But and seven contains
ever are very honest about it in the documentary. So it is, you know, the insights they give are very interesting, I think.
But series 7 contains Rimmerworld.
Yes, it does. Yeah,
which has got to be one of the most loved.
The Rimmerworld song, yes, in blue. Yeah, that's one of my favourite bits as well. That's pure comedy. Yeah,
that is, I think, an exceptional moment of both comedy and of Red Dwarf itself.
Yeah, no, it is. It's a very funny piece, that, I think. Yeah.
Thanks so much for taking time to talk to us. Good luck.
Okay, Mike.
Moving forward, and we look forward to hearing what you're up to next.
Okay, nice talking to you.
That's it for this FX podcast. We're going to take a short break for the holidays, but we'll be back in January with all new podcasts. Also in mid-January, we hope to make some major announcements concerning the site. From all of us, Mike Seymour, John Montgomery, and I'm Jeff Huser, happy holidays from FX Guide.
This podcast is copyright 2005 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC. Thank you.